Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Hello, Tom. Not much has changed in your background. I'm looking, you know, but things are kind of static in your world.
Yeah, it's true. Things don't change until they change for me. So
until they change for everybody. I think that's just the way things work, Tom. Okay. And today, from the land of constant change.
Ish.
Although they've been eating Vegemite sandwiches forever and forever. Oh, he's getting his jar of Vegemite. It's there.
There it is.
It's nice. George Michelson from I don't know, which coast of Australia are you on?
I'm on the East Coast, Russ, and it's lovely to be here again. Hey, Russ. Hi, Tom.
George, are you on the opposite coast from the other, from Jeff?
No, Jeff and I are actually on the same coast, but he's about 2.5 hours by plane south of me in Canberra, which is our diamond-shaped federal structure like you have for DC, except his one isn't diamond-shaped, but it's okay.
Okay, cool. Interesting. Yeah. And are any of the 12 apostles still left? There was this huge argument when I was there.
There was never 12. There was never 12. They call them 12, but there were actually only 7. And there was one called London Bridge that had a beautiful hole through it, and Roche Percée with a hole through it. And there were people who'd been on it, and then they went off it. Bajung! It collapsed. So it became another pinnace. But there's about, I think there's 5 left, maybe 5 or 6.
Oh, wow. Wow. Interesting. Yeah. See, that was
lovely.
A big topic of discussion was the 12 apostles when I was last there.
Oh, so. Yeah. It's a great place. Well worth it. South Coast. Yep.
Yeah, what is it called? What road is that called? The Great Coastal Road or the Great Southern Road?
Yeah, and it's like covered with signs that say, drive on the left, drive on the left. Yeah. Because so many people do tourism straight off the plane, jet lagged, and drift onto the wrong side, and bad things
No, they drift onto the right side.
The correct side.
Sorry, just couldn't resist that. Okay, so today we are talking about energy and networks. And there has been a huge, before you dive in there, there has been a huge effort for many years. I can go back 10 to 15 years and talk about power-aware Ethernet and not leaving carrier on all the time and how you can reduce power usage by just dropping the carrier on Ethernet. But of course, then you have to be able to detect, because somebody on the packet pusher Slack this week asked, well, how does Ethernet know that the link is down? Because you lose power. Like it's literally constant carrier power is what's going on there. And so it's called loss of carrier. And yeah, that's what you get. And there were all this stuff around power aware Ethernet. And now we have an entire thing around power aware routing and trying to reduce energy utilization by making BGP more efficient.
My head is exploding at this point, Russ, because this problem, and there is a real power problem lurking underneath the capital I Internet, and we probably should talk about that, but this idea that we can make substantive change on the surface of the energy burden of the world by making protocols more energy efficient is really grinding my gears.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know. I thought DNS was really bad, though, George.
Well, DNS is evil. I mean, we all know this. But the thing is that we're casting stones at phantom problems at this point, because I think people misunderstand the nature of network systems if they think there's a tractable solution to an energy problem lurking here. And I really do think it's a conversation we need to have, because it's not just a casual conversation, it's leaking into other people's more substantive conversations. And that, to me, is really dangerous stuff.
So what are, so bring me up to speed. What are there some proposals that are attempting to change the protocols to make them more energy efficient?
So as Russ said, there's been this activity for a very long time looking at energy efficiency in switching systems and transmission control systems. So we're talking essentially layer one, layer two, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking the mechanistic ways that people assert binary signal onto communication frameworks, and they are energy intense. I mean, you know, the jokes about with one remaining eye, look into fiber.
Right.
That joke only works because there is a substantial amount of energy in that laser, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, you need a lot of energy to push signal along wires. And so and
all
switching.
All of it's bled off as heat, which is then has to be air conditioned.
Which is an extra burden.
Yeah, unless you're in Greenland.
So we'll come back to that because there's a bit of a story there. But the thing is, there's a valid case to be made at the lower layers. Layer one, there's a technology question. What's the most efficient way to operate frameworks that assert a digital signal? But here's the thing. You move up the ladder and you start hitting this problem that Russ spoke about, you know, loss of context across the wire, loss of signal, loss of continuity. Lots of protocols actually require constant state down at the layer 1-2 boundary to construct a clocked regular signal. They're asserting bits all the time. And the intellectual quality of those bits, the meaning, is encoded in things like phase. It's not amplitude. You don't shout louder, "This is a one! This is a zero." There's no energy change to signal one or zero because of their quality. It's in the phase of the signal that is a reasonably constant energy band, reasonably, that encodes the data.
Well, this is Shannon, right? Before Shannon, what we did was, is if I wanted to take a radio signal from 100 miles to 200 miles, I doubled the amplitude. I just doubled my wattage. That's what I did. After Shannon, what I did was I said, No, I don't need to double my amplitude. I need to find better ways of detecting the signal via phase. I need better ways to encode things on the sidebands using QAM and other things that I can use to encode more data per symbol or per
bit time. So you put an electrical signal into a system, it's going forever within limits. I mean, it becomes a little blurry at the edges. I mean, when we're looking at light coming in from stars a long way away, the energy they put in is still there in the system. That's the law of thermodynamics. The point is that the signal quality, the further away you are, drops off. So you do boost energy to maintain signal coherency at distance. But once you've asserted, I can validly tell you're saying yes or no, one or zero, the energy burden across links is very often constant. If it isn't, if you are able to say, "I'm not looking at you anymore," and the other end can say, "Great, I'll turn off the light," sure, you can reduce the energy cost. But you have now moved to not always on systems. You've moved to an idea of communication that is about having to flag, "I want to talk to you." And that is entirely different to the model we're working on. So down at this one, layer two level, when we talk about energy, the essential message I honestly believe is that most communication systems at large have a semi-constant energy budget to assert data across the wires. Okay. Now, to come back to your point, Tom, there's a conversation happening up at three, up at layer four, maybe leaking into layer five and above, where people are saying, can we change how we do things to help reduce the energy budget? And they're doing it out of good motivations because people care about this stuff. I mean, there is so much going on in the world that people actually do have to sometimes sit up and say, am I part of the problem? And so the whole thing about waste recycling, which we're now all engaged in, sorting our waste, reuse, repurpose, recycle energy. It's not wrong to want to do this stuff, but you also have to understand that there's a kind of get real message. Waste recycling by us consumers after we've bought the goods is not going to fix the crisis in energy waste happening in the production cycles on farms. That's going to take different energy. It's not going to fix the energy burdens and the gas burdens in the production of oil. That's going to take other pressures. At some level, this energy game where we're all doing reduce, waste, recycle is kind of a bit of theatre. And I look at that theatre and I go, I wonder if the stuff we're doing in protocol space is theatre. And you know, I have a really, really strong belief at this point. All of the conversation happening in standardization bodies about energy issues in the internet is theatrical behavior, because no conversation in protocol space above the IEEE's level of the boundary of the network is really going to do anything.
Yeah,
it's right. Not going to help.
Yeah. For at least three reasons. First of all, like you said, the carrier is always there, and the carrier is what eats the power and what generates the heat and blows it off. And if you turn the carrier off, the first question you have to ask is, a first trade-off you have to ask is, what does it take to signal, what does it take to tell the difference between the link being down and the link being turned off at a temporary point of time? And if you can't tell that difference, and there's no mechanical way to know that, then you're actually causing more problems than you're solving. Because what you're going to cause is you're going to cause people to throw packets away as they try to do stuff until the timer times out. And then you're going to say, oh, I've got to retransmit all that. Okay, so if I save an hour's worth of carrier and then I retransmit 10,000 packets, which one of those uses more energy? And you know, it's
these sums have to be done.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
There's trade-offs in here. And the second problem is, you know, when a grid goes down in a city, now it used to be when I was growing up, I think they built more systems to solve this today. But when I was growing up, they would walk around to people's houses. They'd send electrical power company staff down the houses and say, everybody, please turn off your air conditioners and your refrigerators while we turn the grid back on, right?
Because those babies, when they first start up, they do massive spikes of load.
That's right. And the same thing is going to be true of an optic. If I have optic signal running across a fiber and it's just sitting there, fine, even if it's not transmitting anything, if I shut it off, I've got to drive power back down 1,000 mile, 200 mile, whatever it is, optical link. And I've got to bring all the repeaters and amplifiers and all the ROADMs and everything else back online. And it's going to eat so much energy in that startup phase. I mean, it just is. And so I don't know that we think about these trade-offs.
So it is possible to conceive of models of communication that are designed around lower energy burdens. Okay, mm-hmm. So we can say clean slate, if we were doing this in a context where the primary drive was to have energy efficient communications between people, and it's green field, we can all think of ways of doing that. You know, using satellites, if you've already amortized the energy burden to get things up into space, and if they're running on solar cells up in space, and if you can make it work that you do radio signal to them, you can kind of start to say, okay, well, if I'm not using my phone, the radio segment in my phone can shut down, and these things up there have a lower energy cost net in this system. But it's not a trivial decision to say we're all moving to space, to low Earth orbit. Yeah. You actually have to say, but what was the energy burden to get those devices up there in the first place? Right. What is the effect on communication if my phone is having to do, just as Russ said, start-stop engagements with these satellites to say, do you need me? No, I'll shut down. We've all become used to the idea that instant availability in the protocol stack is driving our ability to do things called push. Like, you know, oh, push is when I get to push things to you and you get to push things to me. Well, if you have to initiate every one of those conversations with, let's wait 30 seconds until you check in with me to see if I'm ready for me to tell you stuff, you have changed all of those instant on immediate delivery services. We're reconstructing the social contract around what applications do. So this greenfield conversation, let's build a low energy network. It's got the component, well, it's theater because the current network has constant energy burdens to assert signal. And it's reconstructing a network in order to do low energy means changing applications behavior. This is not a lightweight conversation. And it's got Total energy burden in systems is not a function of the immediate protocol slice of the transaction you do. It's the cost of building out that system, of making that system exist in the first place. You have to be more holistic in how you think about the energy. And I think we've made a mistake.
I mean,
I think theater in most of these cases is actually kind of dangerous. I don't think it's just like, oh, that's theater, that's so annoying. I think it's actually pretty dangerous because it makes us think that we've solved a problem when all we've done is take the gaze off of us. We haven't actually
exactly
solved the problem.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the qualities of the problem. Okay. Energy distribution is not equal. If you have equal energy distribution, you've arrived at the end road of entropy and life is really remarkably boring because we're all a slight shade of blue drifting off. Or is it red? Okay.
So yeah, energy doesn't exist.
Yeah. So by definition, energy distribution is asymmetric because that's what the world is, the lived experience. But in a political sense, energy distribution is not equal is actually a huge problem. Most of the energy consumption happens in the highly developed economies. Strangely enough, most of the internet that we know it is in the highly developed economies. So where is internet growth happening? It's happening in the emerging internet economies. What's the power distribution in the emerging internet economies? Well, they're generally lower power users. They don't have aircon 24/7. They don't have high investment in transmission lines for energy. They actually have weak, unstable, badly maintained energy systems that are not equal to the burden. So internet delivery begs this question. How do you get internet into these economies in an energy effective way?
Right, right. And I can imagine going back and redoing Ethernet in a way that the base carrier is much cheaper when it's not transmitting. For instance, if I'm running 100 gig, I'm actually running four pairs. I could shut off three pairs and keep one pair alive to say the link is up. And when I go to 50 gig, I'll bring the second link up, or 30 gig, I'll bring the second link up, or whatever. Those types of things are possible, except of course, in the case of optical, a light wave is a light wave. I can't shut down just the blue wave or just the red wave, right? The carrier is all colors. So there's some electrical things you can do on the copper side.
Yeah.
But it's a very difficult problem. And like these third world areas, that's going to be, you know, some of the things you might want to be able to do is to make it.
Sure. So designing systems that are energy effective for deployment in marginal energy budget economies, that's actually a really important thing to do. And so questions like how much power is there in my phone and how long is the battery life in my phone? Can I sustain being marginal signal strength in the cellular domain without having to go and find power to plug my phone in? Okay, phone, why am I so obsessed with the phone? Because in these economies, above 90% of internet is about cellular communications and phones. So these people's power budget questions are actually quite existential. Can I have a light bulb tonight, or do I have to charge my phone? And that means I can't have a light bulb. That's a real energy problem. And designing systems which mean at the lower layers of behavior, as Russ says, making decisions around energy costs that you actually can control, that's a huge impact. But here's the thing. What have we been doing this last 5 to 10 years in internet? We've been getting rid of transit. We've been pushing content into CDNs. And the idea is to reduce the RTT, the delay component between me, the consumer, and you, the content provider, because I'm subscribed to Russ. I want his material hot and live as close to me as possible, which means Russ is pushing data to 300 CDNs around the planet. I don't care about the 299 other CDNs because I'm not there, but he's made sure there's one close to me for me to get it quickly. Yeah. And all of his thousands of subscribers are sitting there going, oh, Russ was really good. Russ made that data really fast for me. And I'm going, wow. So let's just roll back a bit where Russ said earlier, oh, it's okay in Greenland. That's a conversation about air conditioning.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that CDN push, Russ, you push that data to Australia, and we have a bit of a problem here when it comes to cooling, I've got to tell you. So what is the energy burden to cool the DC that is the CDN of the world?
Yeah. So two things there. The first is, as Tannenbaum says in his book, Networks, I don't know if you've read it, Computer Networks, in like
long time ago. Roll the clock back.
Yeah, roll the clock back. Is he says, computer networks are a sop to human impatience. That's all they are. We can all do everything we're already doing without networks, pretty much, just more slowly.
Yeah.
And the problem is we're just impatient. And that's Yeah, that's where he gets into his example of the station wagon full of videotapes filled with data, that it's a higher bandwidth than anything.
I thought it was a Cherokee Jeep full of tapes, actually, Russ.
It's a station wagon. It's a station wagon, which you can modernize to, you know, micro SD cards in a small, in a medium size or large size FedEx box.
Yeah.
You cannot buy a link the bandwidth of an overnight FedEx box. Not for any money in the world. You just can't buy it.
But I would actually want to understand if the energy burden of the 747 perpetually flying Netflix's catalog around 300 DCs is a good trade compared to shipping that data over fiber. But I'm kind of trying to get to this point that if once you say we're going with CDNs and we're eroding transit, you're saying we're going with 24/7 air conditioning power supply constraints in a machine room. Now, you said, but it's okay in Greenland. And there's a rather funny story that I only have a small segment of about a fire, probably in Chicago recently, that affected the integrity of the cooling system of a DC during a significant cold weather event. Rather weird effect happened. They had to turn off the cooling because it turns out when it's super cold outside, the air conditioning units actually can't handle it.
Yeah.
And so
that's correct. Yeah.
I'm kind of going, why didn't they just open the doors and allow this beautiful rush of cold air to come in? But there's the other side of air conditioning. It's not just temperature, it's humidity. Oh, yes. The humidity. Yes. So they couldn't do anything because it was the wrong quality of cold and humidity. They were screwed on cold.
Well, that's the reason they don't have open doors and data centers. And that's one reason in Greenland. The other reason is because the wind is so high that if you get an 80-mile-an-hour gust, which is not unusual in Nook, I mean, they have special windows in all their houses and stuff because it's 80-mile-an-hour gust. It's like, yeah, whatever. We had that 2 weeks ago, like whatever. And so, yeah, you know, you can't take an 80-mile-an-hour gust into the open doors of your data center or it just like destroys things. So, yeah, so I mean, there's all this, there's lots of other problems there. But I mean, we looked at this when we were talking about Greenland as well, because those people have in this villages up the West Coast, they'll have 100 people living in a village and they'll want medical care. They want remote medical care. They want telemedicine. And they want to be able to watch movies at night like everybody else does, right?
This is fundamental quality of life decisions here. Yeah,
this is what it is. And so what we originally designed, which I don't think was ever deployed, but what we originally designed was basically a small site, a point of presence at every one of these villages with two racks of servers, three racks of servers. And you would have a small generator and a big generator. And the big generators run the village and the small generator runs the data center, basically. And it's on 24/7. And the data center has like movies and pre-recorded messages and voicemail and whatever else that you can hold off on. So the next day when the big generator comes on, when everybody wakes up, all their stuff is there.
Yeah.
And, you know, but then so that's
this,
the energy.
This is being mindful about energy budgets set against human behavior, because there probably is a night owl in Nook who's sitting there at 2 a.m. kind of silently cursing that the main power's off because they're saving energy for the village, but the low power budget component in this problem is on so they can watch Netflix at 2 a.m. And those trade-offs, those are good trade-offs, but nobody changed a protocol to do it.
Especially not BTP. Okay, there is a shiny lining in this horrible looking rain cloud, though, is that if we decide that we put too much in BGP to make it energy efficient, maybe we'll just start pulling stuff out.
No, it's never going to happen, Russ.
So I have two kind of numbers in my head that I want to float here. So one of them, and it's a fact that has come off the internet, so it is true, and it says it's somewhere between 3.5% and 6% of global energy burden is in the internet. Now, I would contest that true fact because I think it's really contextual to what you think the internet is. And I would suspect that the emergence of a transit avoiding CDN pushed internet actually has a higher burden because the electricity component of DC worldwide is really surging. We're talking about Amazon entering into a long-term supply contract with a baseload design centralized power supply. I mean, it's nuclear. So the headline is Amazon goes nuclear. It's not nuclear. It's electricity. They bought electricity by going close to a generator. It could have been coal. It could have been horses working around in a circle running a generator. It happens to be nuclear because the nuclear energy supply chain is looking at this thing called the duck curve, where the insertion of wind and solar is altering the need for constant load energy, and it's affecting their profitability because nuclear energy is essentially steam turbines for most people, and steam turbines really like constant load. Now, a DC, as it happens, is actually pretty much constant load. And so they are the perfect client for a constant load energy machine. It's a natural pairing. But the story really wasn't nuclear. The story was co-locate DCs with efficient energy production systems.
Well, so and if you look at it, right, Amazon in particular is building local regions now and outposts. So they are actually expanding the size of their network, which helps them to compete against people like Akamai and Fastly and Cloudflare. Got it?
Yeah.
Which is going to push other people to do the same thing, which, you know, drives back into your, are we really thinking about the trade-offs in energy versus convenience? But normally we don't. We just think it's more convenient, I'm doing it. Right?
So the other thing that is the kind of factoid that I got off the internet is I found a Quora page where somebody said, if I download a lot of music to my phone, does it get heavier? And you sort of think, no. And then someone wrote back saying, well, actually, charge in memory systems in computers represents imbalances in electron states. And if you weigh the electrons, in order to create those imbalances, you have probably added 10 to the minus 18 grams of weight to your device in order to create that state. And here's my arithmetic. And so your BGP thing, I'm sitting here going, it maybe didn't burn more energy, Russ, but the router got heavier.
That could well be. I don't know. So yeah, I mean, yeah, but I think you're right. I think once we get above the physical layer and you might have some justification in the data link layer to worry about energy, but once you get above those, it becomes very difficult to,
But we shouldn't trivialize the question, does the internet represent an energy burden on the planet? It absolutely does. And we need to think about that. But if we go down this path of thinking by redesigning internet technologies in protocol stacks, we will solve the problem. Then I think, Tom, we've been taken to that theater of the wrong sort. It's a distraction from the real problem.
Yeah. And why can't the minds that are so interested in making BGP more energy efficient, why can't they also work on the lower layer stuff? Maybe they didn't do it in their career, but maybe, you know, we should be putting the mental cycles in the place that need it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the place they need it is quite contextual to the situation we find ourselves in. I have to say that I don't think BGP is it. And even the physical layer, I'm looking at it going, I'm starting to feel like we should ask some meta questions. So I read quite a long time ago, please correct me if I'm wrong, but 48 volt DC distribution in racks may actually be substantially more efficient than 240 and 110 with a local power supply down to DC in every computer. Is that true?
Okay. So AC tends to run long distances without while losing power less, more efficiently. Yeah.
Which is why the long haul line tends to be high frequency AC. Right.
This is Edison's loss with Edison Power, because he tried to build a DC distribution system in Manhattan and it failed because you just can't transmit DC across
long distances.
Yeah, across Manhattan, just not possible. In a data center, however, we're not talking about long distances. And so, and you lose a lot of power in converting from DC to AC. You bleed
sure,
a lot.
Sure, even these new gallium nitride power bricks that are more efficient, there is net loss doing this conversion, isn't
yes. it? Yeah, it bleeds a lot of heat. You bleed a lot of heat. Almost every AC to DC power supply I've ever worked on bleeds a lot of heat. It is more efficient to convert once and distribute it once, because you can centralize it very efficient. And you can position things so that the heat bleed off is not distributed throughout the data center. You can distribute it directly to the outside and reduce your cooling cost, or through an evaporative cooler directly. So yeah, there are ways of, it is better in general to blow DC.
See, this conversation to me is the conversation that goes to the direction that's useful here, because the supply chain dynamics for getting kit into racks has to move to a pace of energy where people say, I'm not giving you dual redundant 240 power supply on the back of this baby. I'm giving you dual redundant 48 in wired for the supply of 48 or 60 or whatever the current voltage is, DC. And we're going to have absolute guarantees, cast iron guarantees. The airflow through this computer matches your outer system, hot aisle, cold aisle model. All of those design imperatives, architecting a DC for low energy, chef's kiss.
Yep. You could probably, I don't know what the percentage of power that bleeds off in the power supply of each box up there sitting in a rack, you know, converting 240 or 120, generally it's 240. Down to 12 volts or whatever is used on the motherboard. Most of the time it's 5 and 12 volts is what you end up with. But I would almost, it seems like you could reduce your fan volume. You could reduce just the sheer amount of air you've got to pull through.
Yeah. I mean,
all the chipsets and optics, of course, bleed a lot of heat. So I don't know about optics, because I've not studied a lot of optical and what they do in heat dissipation. All my experience with electronics is older than optical communications for the most part. But I don't know, you know, even like when I used to work on radar systems, you would walk into the shelter, and the shelter was the shelter where the magnetron was, where the primary transmitter was. And that puppy was putting off 250,000 watts at 1.2 gigahertz. And that shelter
Robert Baderi tells a story about early radar systems that the sailors on the ships knew that it was slightly warmer if you went and leant up against the control room where they were running radar.
Oh, yeah. That shelter was always warm. Like, it was, even in the heart of winter, there could be 6-8 inches of snow on the ground, and you would still be running air conditioners in that shelter, because it was like, holy mackerel, that thing bled so much heat. But, you know, the power supply is pulling a 240 circuit, and it's converting that 240 into, you know, 250,000 watts at, I don't know, 1 amp at 25,000 volts or whatever. And there's a lot of circuitry that goes into that to make that kind of conversion happen. And so, yeah, all these things bleed heat. And so the fewer places you can bleed heat, the better.
To me, that's the real conversation in our space, in our domain. Protocols have energy cost. Absolutely true. Changing protocols to reduce energy cost, a lot harder than you think it is, requires rethinking the social contract around the behavior of systems. You can't just casually achieve the outcome you're wanting by shrinking the size of the BGP default free zone. It doesn't work that way. Is it a net good that we have a more efficient routing framework? Maybe, but it's not in energy. So now, was the energy problem a phantom? No, the energy problem is real. But we should be talking about the real points of the energy problem. And they're not in the protocol stack. They're in the air conditioning plant.
Yeah. And we should be able to talk about things like, do we need to have intermittent routing to areas that only have intermittent power? How do we solve that problem?
Yeah.
That is a real problem. It really needs to be solved.
Yeah. Are we going to reduce the construction cost of ground plant infrastructure, rural and remote, if we move into low Earth orbit? Are we actually going to get rid of a concrete production energy burden? Because concrete is unbelievably energy intense. You mine stuff, that's energy. You ship it to the concrete factory, that's energy. You roast it, well, that's heat energy. You mix it with an energy. You ship it, that's energy. You pour it and it releases CO2 and related things. Yes. It's not a good system. So if we don't have to build concrete investments in the ground because we're using radio signals to space and doing low Earth orbit, maybe that's beneficial for the net energy budget in a developing economy. That's a good conversation, but it never touched the protocol.
Yeah, or even thinking about this, right? Even if you could say, all right, for all you video people out there who watch video, or who serve video all the time, if you charged 50 cents less, if you scheduled all your video the night before you were going to watch it, so I could just gather all the requests up and ship it once, right?
Yeah.
And save the energy of storing everything everywhere all the time. So it's all immediate on demand all the time.
Yeah.
Is that something? Like, can you do financial trade-offs against the impatience of the human person?
Hey, here's an idea. Netflix could send people DVDs. Yeah, we could do this, right? Why don't we suggest to Netflix that they stop with this CDN thing and ship CDs and DVDs to people? I think you're onto something, Russ. This is good.
Did you do that once? Didn't Netflix have a DVD service for some
period? That's how they started.
That's how they bootstrapped, man. Itchy and Scratchy was being shipped to you in advance. Now you just go and troll the back catalog for season 21, but it used to be different. And you know, kids of today, you don't know how lucky you are. It was actually okay. It was fine. It's an okay way to do things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just think, you could still engorge yourself on every I Love Lucy that was ever made, because they could just ship you the DVDs.
I loved I Love Lucy.
Ones, right?
God, and then you I love could just that
ship
show.
Them all back, right?
Yeah. I think Desi was okay, but Lucy Star Trek, Lucy is a really smart lady. She did good.
Now you know that whole show was originally supposed to be the Desi show.
Yeah, well, Lucy has a bigger personality, right? I mean, the wine making scene. Who can forget the wine making scene?
Or the chocolate factory, or even the two aliens on the roof. Those are classic moments in television. Anyway,
yeah.
Now half the audience is going, who's Lucy?
Yes.
So to summarize, we can trade off human impatience against the energy problem. We've just solved it. You're welcome, world.
Yeah. Welcome. Thank you for coming to our TED Talk. Goodbye. Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's quite interesting that the admission question is kind of, we have a serious problem in energy, and the assumption that the solving it is in us because we're network engineers and we have the strength. And the outcome is, we're not the problem and we're not relevant.
Well, I think that's a lot of the problem with the networking world is we want to be relevant
far
more often than we actually are.
Yeah, the desperate search for relevancy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and honestly, we're just not relevant to a lot. It's not that's not bad, right? So, yeah. Okay. All righty then. So, Do you have anything else to say there, George, before we...
No, I think I'm kind of done here. I'm out of gas.
George is going to go drink a cup of coffee or something because he needs his energy back.
Yeah, I have to recoup my energy levels. But Tom, Russ, this has been a blast. I love talking with you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, likewise.
So we're scheduling another one. We just have to schedule it.
Yeah. Next week is IETF week, when a lot of hot air is going to be talked. Maybe we can do something the week after.
Week after something. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
All right, George, where can people follow you if they want to, or get in touch, or whatever?
I'm working at apnic.net, and I contribute to the blog there at blog.apnic.net, and I have a podcast called Ping. I'm the host of Ping, which is APNIC's channel for discussing internet measurement in the wider sense. And it's lovely if people subscribe to that and think about the measurement question at large. And if you've got an interesting story to tell, that's where you go.
George. Yeah, get in touch with George, because he's always looking for measurement people.
I am.
Yeah, awesome. All right, Tom, how about you?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn, and that's it.
And LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
Or LinkedIn.
Yeah, also LinkedIn.
Yeah, also LinkedIn. Yeah.
Russ, how do we find you?
You don't find me.
You don't find him, he finds you.
And then you're in trouble.
So I'm Russ White. I'm always here at The Hedge at rule11.tech. You can find me on LinkedIn. I do check Twitter, X now, every now and again. And you can always, it's easy to find my email. If you have a suggestion for The Hedge or a topic you'd like us to cover, please let us know. And if you'd like to be a guest, please let us know, because we love guests too. So we know that we live in an attention economy, and that your time and attention are important. So thanks for spending this time with us. Thanks for listening to The Hedge, and we will catch you next time.